coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The state of Delaware is moving to the next phase of its vaccine distribution plan, focusing on the state's senior population.
Right now, we really want to get as much vaccine available to those who are 65 and older, simply because we want to save lives and we want to prevent hospitalizations. This is our focus.
We talk with Division of Public Health Director Dr. Carol Rattay about the plan and the challenges it faces. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also look at a historic preservation success story in Newcastle County. Arts Playlist previews the latest exhibition at the Delaware Contemporary. And Enlighten Me highlights work from student journalists at the University of Delaware. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Across the country, distribution of coronavirus vaccines has been criticized as disorganized and slow. Delaware recently entered the second phase of its distribution plan, which makes seniors, as well as frontline essential workers like teachers and food manufacturers, eligible to get shots. The first day the state's online registration system went live, tens of thousands of Delawareans 65 and older signed up. But the state's supply of the vaccine is lagging behind. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt this week talked with State Division of Public Health Director Dr. Carol Rattay about how distribution is going so far and the state's plan to get its most vulnerable residents vaccinated quickly.
So the state has not finished vaccinating everyone eligible under Phase 1A, which was healthcare professionals, nursing home residents and staff, and first responders like EMS. So why move to Phase 1B?
Yeah, so we always knew that we would be overlapping phases. What was really important is that we provide opportunities for those in one phase to get vaccinated, but when we're able to move on to the next phase. So we started December 15th. Hospitals got the vaccine and began vaccinating staff. And you know, since that time, there have been multiple different opportunities for Phase 1A folks in the state to get vaccinated, including a number of large vaccination events. I should also mention that important to 1A is long-term care. This is a federal program called the Federal Pharmacy Program, where they're going to each long-term care facility in our state and vaccinating staff and residents. So that's still underway. But, now we are more than ready to protect our most vulnerable population, those over age 65 in the state. So really thrilled that we moved to 1B.
So Governor Carney has admitted that Phase 1A distribution didn't really go as quickly as possible. That was mostly through partners, right? Like the hospitals. Can you walk me through how those partnerships for the distribution worked and why it didn't move as fast as it could have?
Yeah, I think there were a number of complicating aspects to this. I mean, one is just the timing. This all happened right before the holidays. And, you know, many healthcare providers were really excited to get vaccine. But then there were a lot of folks who were like, I don't know that I want to get this vaccine before the holidays. And so we saw more vaccine hesitancy than I think we would have seen if it wasn't right before the holidays. So although that picked up after the holidays, not everyone agreed to be vaccinated in the through the hospital system.
So I guess one of my questions is about the way that the phases overlap. How will sort of the prioritization work in terms of 1A versus 1B? And then looking ahead to 1C, is there a chance that, for example, you know, a 60-year-old who has a bunch of underlying conditions could receive the vaccine before a healthy 70-year-old?
Yeah, so 1A still has an opportunity to get vaccinated, but now that we've moved on, it may be harder for them to get vaccinated. The focus right now is 1B, and especially those who are 65 and older. So we're prioritizing even within the phases. Right now, we really want to get as much vaccine
available to those who are 65 and older, simply because we want to save lives and we want to prevent hospitalizations. This is our focus. There's also essential workforce, a frontline workforce who are in 1B. We'll be slowly rolling that out. I don't want to say that's less of a priority, but again, we are really focused on saving lives right now as much as we can. We know that for those who are under 65 with chronic conditions, it's really hard to wait. But, you know, we have a lot of people in this phase 1B group, over 200,000 people, which is for our population, a fifth of the population in the state of Delaware. So it is going to take us a little bit of time to get through this phase. We still have extremely limited vaccine supply. And I know that that's really hard for folks in the 1C group, especially those with chronic underlying conditions. But we ask them to do what's so difficult and be patient until we have enough vaccine to move on to that phase. We really want to make sure that all folks over 65 have an opportunity for a vaccine before we move over into 1C.
For those eligible in phase 1B because of their profession, and this includes teachers, childcare workers, food manufacturers like poultry workers, they'll be receiving it either through their employer directly or through pharmacy vouchers. Is that right? So is it basically first come, first serve within that group?
First, we really want people to look to their employer to give them guidance as far as when and where and how they get their vaccine. So you can't just go to a pharmacy that's providing vaccines right now for 65 and up, which is what we've asked them to focus on, and say, hey, I'm a teacher, I need my vaccine right now. DOE, Department of Education, is done a really great job of coordinating an approach to work with pharmacy partners and others to get vaccine out to their workforce. But again, even within that group, it's important to prioritize. So first focusing on teachers and school staff who are 65 and older, and focus on, for example, special education teachers, where oftentimes their students aren't good mask wearers. Child care providers would be another example where many will get a voucher. It's unlikely that we'll be doing a lot of on-site vaccination, that partners will go on-site to vaccinate, since a lot of childcare sites are small, so the voucher program works well for them. But like poultry plants, as a very different example, they have employee health right there on-site, and they can set up to do their own vaccination for their employees. So they'll be taking a very different approach. And that's why, you know, we've been working for months now with different employers on what's the best approach for them. But again, I'll emphasize that'll be rolling out slowly based on vaccine supply.
Mm-hmm. So obviously the logistics of distributing this are not at all easy. The state is moving to an appointment-based system for those 65 and over, prioritized by age and underlying conditions. People will get invitations and they'll have to respond. What are you going to do to deal with no-shows? There's obviously a pressure to administer every dose you've thawed and allocated for an event. Last weekend during the drive-thrus, we did see some cases where like impromptu vaccinations outside the eligible groups. Do you expect that to happen again?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. I mean, first, we're really excited to launch this registration system today. We don't want people waiting. We don't want people showing up at 6 a.m. for, you know, a 10 o'clock appointment. You know, this is really going to help organize the approach and make sure that we match, you know, the right amount of doses to the right amount of people who will come every day. In future, for future events, we know last weekend was a little bit of an anomaly, but moving forward, people will be required to have registered for these events. So we don't want people showing up to get vaccinated who have not been registered for those events. So that will be a change. We really are maximizing the number of people that we can get through each time, recognizing that there may be some no-shows. Over the coming weeks,
that landscape is going to change. I mean, already now, number of healthcare providers have vaccine, and although it's limited amounts, they're reaching out to their highest risk patients and asking them to come in. Pharmacies, we're going to see a growing number of our pharmacies, our pharmacy stores, with vaccine and offering appointments for folks 65 and up. And there'll be other vaccination events, not just the DPH vaccination events. So as the landscape grows and more opportunities are available, you know, we're telling people, take the first opportunity you have, and that will likely increase some of our no-shows. So we'll just adjust for that as we move forward.
So you mentioned that Delaware has a limited supply right now, and currently there's not nearly enough to cover that 200,000 1B population. So can you talk to me a little bit about what the flow of doses to Delaware looks like right now? Do you expect that to change under a Biden administration? Do you see it as enough right now? And I guess what's the plan to get enough going forward?
That's a great question. And we often don't know. Today, we'll receive the numbers for what we'll receive next week. So we don't know from week to week what we're going to be receiving, but it's relatively small amounts. I mean, maybe around 12 to 14,000 doses. So it's not a lot. We are really eager to get more doses. I'm not sure anyone has a full sense of what the manufacturing supply situation looks like. I mean, we were told by the Trump administration last week that the supply looks good, but you know, our numbers certainly aren't reflecting that. We were told by the Trump administration last week that we would be receiving a lot of second doses, and that also is not coming to fruition. So there's just a lot of unknowns that have made us need to be flexible, really not being able to predict how much is coming here, and then how do we organize our events and distribution accordingly.
Mm-hmm. The governor mentioned that demonstrating the ability to move doses will hopefully increase the number that Delaware is allocated. Can you talk a bit about how that's determined, and is that something you guys know for sure, or is that just a hope?
Yeah, so that's what was announced by the Trump administration last week. We don't know what that looks like. I had a conversation with General Perna, who is the key for the Operation Warp Speed last week, and he said that they don't really know what this is going to look like, but states who aren't doing well could be penalized. We're not in that category of states that aren't doing well. But nonetheless, it's important to us to, you know, get every dose into Delawareans as fast as we can. And we certainly would not ever want to be, you know, penalized for not moving fast enough.
Got it. Both of the vaccines that the state's distributing require a second shot a few weeks after the first. The state has changed the policy in terms of holding back enough doses. Obviously, the guidance around that has changed too. So I know the state plans to send reminders about when you need to get your second shot, but how do people who are getting vaccinated in the next few weeks make sure that they're going to get that? And how can you guys kind of guarantee that there will be enough at that point?
Yeah. So first of all, this is another reason why we really like this new registration system. Everybody has to have an email address in this system, which it's one of the easiest ways to remind people about when their second dose should be, you know, just remind them, hey, you got the Moderna or you got the Pfizer. So what we're telling people is, let's say you got the Moderna, you know, 28 days after your first dose, you want to make sure that you set up an appointment for your second dose. You know, by the time a lot of these folks are ready for their second dose, there will be more options for them, whether it's pharmacy, healthcare provider, or these mass clinics, so that they can choose. As far as making sure that there is enough vaccine, I mean, that's going to be a tough balance to strike, but we can control how many. For example, in these vaccination events, we can control how many are for first dose and for second dose. So that should help. But we also do want to make sure people know, you know, you don't have to get it 28 days after your first dose. You can get it, 45 days, and it's still okay. You want to get it as close to your first dose or to 28 days after your first dose as possible. But if it's a little bit challenging to find it, we don't want people to panic. We will make sure that everybody gets their second rounds.
Dr. Carol Rattay, Director of the Division of Public Health, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sophia. Next on The Green, we take a look at a historic preservation success story in Newcastle County. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We've covered historic preservation a fair amount in recent years, and usually the story is about the failure to protect buildings of significance from demise. But this week, contributor Larry Dangest offers a more hopeful story, as one building in northern Newcastle County avoids that fate. That building is the Jester Farmhouse, and Larry's story on its rebirth is available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me to discuss how it avoided being lost and what's next for that space. So, Larry, let's start a little bit with the background on the Jester Farmhouse. So what is its significance?
Well, okay, the farmhouse was built along Grub Road in the early 1800s on land that was then known as the Wilson Farm. It is shown on an 1849 map that it belonged to a Robert Johnson. The property was then owned by the Day family from about the time of the Civil War until around World War II. The farmhouse, which is one of the few remaining in Brandywine Hundred, was typical of those found throughout the area in the mid-19th century. With its surrounding fields, it shows what farming was like in the area before it became dominated by suburban subdivisions. The structure is distinct because it was made of stone, and then a wood frame addition was built onto it in the late 19th century. Although the Day family owned the farm for nearly a century, it gets its name from Francis and Eleanor Jester, who owned the property from 1953 to 1974 and then sold it to Newcastle County.
So how close did it come to being lost? Your piece notes it has struggled to find help and a purpose.
Well, when the county acquired the farm, 30 acres or so, in 1974, it had a long-term plan to create a park there that was deemed to be a great need for another recreational facility in Brandywine Hundred. But it didn't really have any plans for the farmhouse. Now, plans for the park languished, and this really wasn't all that big a deal because the owners of the High Point Dairy had leased the land as a place for their cows to graze. However, after the Jesters moved out, except for a few very brief periods, the farmhouse was vacant, and the county did nothing at all to maintain it. Periodically, some ideas did pop up. A soccer organization wanted to put some playing fields on the land. The dairy's owner suggested something like a community creamery for the farmhouse, but none of these ideas worked out.
So what was the turning point for its preservation? Who stepped up to kind of take up the cause?
Well, nearly 20 years ago, members of the Day family, who still lived in the area, helped convince the county not to demolish the farmhouse. Also helping in that effort was Todd Baston, who lived across the street from the farm, and he hated to see the building deteriorate. Over Christmas in 2015, he expressed his concerns to his son, Alan Baston, and they started brainstorming some ideas. Alan Baston had an arts background, so he contacted some other artists, and in less than a year, they had an idea for a gathering space for artists in the community. Meanwhile, the county had this program called Resident Curatorships. The idea behind it was to get people to spend $150,000 or more to fix up historic properties and then agree to live in them for 20 years rent-free, paying only the maintenance costs. But the program had few takers, and when Baston's group made its proposal, the county recognized the merits of turning a portion of this parkland into a cultural space.
And that is where we get what is now being called the Jester Art Space. So what exactly is that, and how does it plan to use the building?
Well, the Jester Art Space is a nonprofit organization. Right now, they've got a core group of about 20 volunteers. And when they pitched the idea to the county in 2016, since there was no takers on the resident curatorship, the county agreed to come up with a lease arrangement for them. Now, the group plans to use the building for a variety of different purposes, art exhibits, classes, workspace for artists, and they would even expect to be able to rent the building out for special events.
But creating the Jester Art Space has faced some hurdles. How difficult has it been for this group to get their plan off the ground?
Well, as you might expect, the big hurdle was getting the structure into usable condition. So the deal between the art space and the county called for the county to get the exterior into shape, and the art space would handle the interior improvements. The county would also handle landscaping plus paving for parking and an entry road. However, the original plan came in way over the county's budget, so the exterior work had to be scaled back, and some changes had to be made because the wood frame walls had deteriorated during all those years of neglect.
So, Larry, where do things stand now? What's the timetable for completion of this project? And what about the space around the building?
Okay. Well, as of now, the demolition work on the site is nearly complete. If you looked at it today, you would see 2.5 stone walls still standing, and that leaves a pretty clear view of a bare interior. There's no roof. The second floor is gone. The county says the work that it is paying for, essentially reconstructing the exterior so it looks much like it did in the late 1800s, but with modern materials, should be done by the end of June. Now, the Jester Art Space people hope that they can complete the interior work by September or October so they can start using the building before the end of the year. Overall, the county is putting about $1.3 million into the project, and the art space figures the interior work will cost about $250,000, but they're hoping to get some donations of labor and materials to keep their expenses down. As for the surrounding property, essentially farmland, the county is turning this into a neighborhood park, essentially passive recreation. They're going to put in walking, biking, pedestrian trails in a double loop configuration. So it would pretty much go around the exterior of the park, and there would also be entrance pathways in from the couple of developments that surround it. The county is hoping to get that done by the end of the year, but that's still kind of iffy.
So, Larry, what have we learned from the preservation of the Jester Farmhouse about handling other properties in need of preservation? What are the options likely to be used going forward from here?
Well, you know, the saga of the Jester Farmhouse shows that every episode of what preservationists call demolition by neglect doesn't have to have an unhappy ending. Interested groups that have adequate resources can find ways to create new uses for historic structures. But while the county expects the farmhouse to be a success story, the government also has some work to do. 9 years ago, the county did identify 5 properties, including the Jester Farmhouse, as candidates for the resident curatorship program. As I mentioned, there's a trade-off here. The resident agrees to spend $150,000 or more for 5 years and then take care of the ongoing maintenance in exchange for living in the building rent-free for a 20-year term. But there's a problem. Banks aren't going to loan prospective curators $150,000 when they can't use the building as collateral, and that's a lot of money to put up if you've got nothing to show for it when your lease is up. So as a consequence, people are more likely to go and, you know, use whatever savings they have, buy their own home rather than invest in something where you've got nothing at when you're ready to move out. So anyhow, the resident curatorship has worked at only one of the 5 county-owned properties that were identified for the program. The other issue here is that the county never had a plan for maintaining the farmhouse for all the time that it has owned it. County Councilwoman Dee Durham has a proposed ordinance in the pipeline that would attempt to address that issue. Her proposal, which should come up for a county vote and county council vote this spring, would require that whenever the county acquires a property with historic significance, that it begin the process of giving it historic overlay zoning within 90 days of the acquisition. Now, historic overlay zoning sets some restrictions on how the property can be used, but it doesn't specifically address this issue of the maintenance. And now another member of County Council that I was talking to pointed out that, you know, it's kind of hypocritical for the county to penalize property owners for violations of the county's building maintenance code when it's not taking proper care of its own property as well. So maybe there's a need for additional legislation in this area.
So you mentioned that only one of the resident curatorship properties has worked out the way the county had hoped. Can you give us any specifics on how that one actually worked out?
Well, the success story is a place called Woodstock, which is a home that was built in 1743, and it's located in Banning Park, just outside of Wilmington, just southwest of the city. And the county found a couple who had the money to put into the reservations, and the county people tell me that the couple is doing a fantastic job with maintaining the place after putting substantial funds into getting it into livable, habitable condition. Now, of course, at the other end of the spectrum, as I said, only one of these five has worked out, but at the other end of the spectrum, there's Ivyside in Bechtel Park in Brandywine 100 and the Tally Day House, which is behind the Brandywine 100 Library. Now, there have been a couple of nibbles on Ivyside, but nothing workable. Councilman John Cartier says that an American Legion post that's based in Claymont is looking for a home, and Ivyside might be suitable, but again, it would take a deal along the lines of the one arranged at Jester, with the county putting up the money for renovations to make that happen. Now, the Tally Day House has attracted absolutely no interest, and frankly, that's quite understandable. The old house, again, early mid-19th century farmhouse, it's surrounded now by so much foliage and trees that it can barely be seen, except by the vandals who have done substantial damage to the place, enough damage that the county has boarded up all the windows and doorways to it. The county hasn't made any investment in the structure, and I really can't imagine it being anything other than a victim of demolition by neglect. Not quite sure how long it'll be before that happens, but I'm really don't see any other alternatives right now.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. His piece on the Jester Farmhouse is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. The Green continues with Arts Playlist and a preview of the new exhibition at the Delaware Contemporary in Wilmington. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Delaware Contemporary in Wilmington, like many art institutions, closed for a good part of 2020 because of the coronavirus pandemic, but by midsummer, it reopened with limited hours. Now, with a new year comes new life, and the Delaware Contemporary's executive director, Leslie Schaefer, says that starts with a winter-spring season series called Objectifying the Object. The series is made up of six separate exhibits running through May. And for this week's Arts Playlist, Schaefer speaks with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about this series and the organization's effort to present art during the pandemic.
You know, Leslie, COVID-19 has really not gone anywhere just yet. However, the good news surrounding the Delaware Contemporary, you guys have since reopened, correct?
We reopened actually the first week of June. So we reopened both inside and then with our new exterior program for those people who you know, felt more comfortable viewing art from the comfort of their car, for the comfort of the street. So we've been open since June. Currently, we are open on a reduced schedule, but still 4 days a week.
Before we get into what's coming up at the Delaware Contemporary, mm-hmm. let's talk about how you guys weathered the storm.
I think what was probably our most successful, again, is this outdoor presence that we have launched this year. It was a new initiative that was planned for June about a year ago, and we were able to get it going. And with the first project, we brought in somebody who is a Baltimore native, went to DCAD, and then has now landed in New York. Teresa Cromati and her worked on the outside of the building. We were then able to have her show inside of our exhibition galleries, as well as some programs that asked artists, contemporary artists working today, how they responded to being at home, to being shuttered. And so we presented a work that was curated via Instagram. And those works were shipped to us, and in a very safe way, our exhibition director installed them in an exhibition. We asked the community to come in and write on our walls again, one at a time, and respond to current issues that were happening across the summer with regard to the protests, with regard to being shuttered as well. And then lastly, we brought in our most, our closest community, and that is our studio artists. And they did a show, and actually, Kelly, I have to say, based on our last conversation, it was called Unshuttered. And so it brought out from their studios the things that they had been working on from March until mid-June. And so that was fun. And we were able to successfully then present an exhibition cycle starting in September. And that just closed right after the new year. And that was another suite of six shows. And how we've been dealing with it is that we're working on a limited cycle. Our visitor hours are limited to just those 4 days. We offered members of the museum an additional evening to come in. We have also, I think like many other institutions, presented our public programming via Instagram, via Facebook, streaming media, things like that. I think the biggest project that we did while shuttered was our Art and Couture fashion event. That had been scheduled for April, and we were unfortunately unable to present a live fashion event. It had turned itself into what we felt like was the next most successful, and that was a documentary film. The artist, Sean Baron Pinckney, who is a couture, created a suite of 24 costumes, or as he called them, looks. And those looks were based on the suffragettes from the 1920s. And they took the shape of flappers. They took the shape of women who started to work in men's clothing, pantsuits, and things like that. Their evening wear, and then also the colors that they wore when they were protesting for the right to vote. He additionally created seven VIP outfits for women across the state of Delaware that have had a significant impact on the role of women today. So Lisa Blunt Rochester, Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester, our new Senator Sarah McBride, Carol Arnott Robbins. He created a costume for Ashley Biden, Senator Tizzy Lockman, Susan Kelleher, who is a VP at Chemours and has really changed the culture at Chemours for women and across her institution. And for our Lieutenant Governor, Bethany Hallong. And so those costumes were worn by these women and were interviewed within our exhibition galleries one-on-one with the artists. And it's a fantastic documentary that we were able to then produce and distribute virtually because we could not have it in person.
It was fantastic. For people who missed it, is it still available?
It is available. And, you know, I think you just go out to our website, and it's available from our website.
Hey, let's talk about the new winter-spring season, if you will, at the Delaware Contemporary. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Leslie Schaefer. Leslie is the executive director. We've talked to her many times, the executive director of the Delaware Contemporary. So the winter-spring season is here. Explain the title, Objectifying the Object.
You know, we've decided to move into the seasonal schedule. It really makes it a lot easier for the visitor to identify what's happening here. In the past, we staggered our exhibitions, but now we're putting a lot of energy into grouping them together. And the groupings are kind of loosely related to a theme. And objectifying the object is really we all have objects, right? We all in our lives, you know, sitting on my desk, I have anywhere from pens to hand cream to a coffee, you know, and all of those objects have varying meaning. What happens when they come into a gallery or a museum space? How does that object change? And additionally, how do we define what object is? And so all of these exhibitions, to some degree, question our relationship to that definition of object. And so we have a suite of 6 exhibitions that will be here all the way through the end of May, giving people lots of opportunity to see the shows, to engage in a whole variety of programs. And these programs look at the object in different ways. They bounce off each other to question what each other is saying. They take a fresh look on it. For example, we have the Wilmington Ballet coming in to do these little vignettes in the exhibition galleries. We have a Raku artist. We have one of my favorite projects that we're presenting this spring is by a young Philadelphia-based artist named Jasmine Combs. And we came to know Jasmine this fall, but in her work here this spring, she has written a new poem. It's called Definitive Work, and it is in response to this idea about objectification. She will read her poem, and then we have students who will respond to it. So it's a unique way of thinking about the object, where the object is this spoken word. It's not a physical, tangible thing, but then it becomes these paintings or drawings or small sculptural pieces that students create based on her words.
This is just totally fantastic. There's Definitive Work. That's one of the exhibition titles. I'm looking at the list. Talk about Appearances a little bit. That's another one.
Yeah, so Appearances is also really fun. One of our studio artists, Lauren Peters, presented this idea for her studio artist April show. And because we were unable to be open in April, we asked her to expand it. And so she has almost 20 artists that she has given the image of herself, which is the way that she works. She's a self-portraitist, working in very bright colors. She dons herself in many different ways, different appearances. And so she gave every artist the exact same work, which is called Self-Portrait Orange. The background is orange. And she's wearing a pink wig that's sort of a bob-like. And each of these artists took that and either, I don't want to give it away because I want people to come see it, but they worked in all media, from photography. I saw clothing. I've seen a video and, of course, paintings that are similar to hers, but some are abstract, some are realistic, but they're in response to this object, this one object, and how they are interpreting that work and how they are presenting it within the body of their own body of work.
Very, very interesting. Another exhibition title, Bend, Breathe. Mm-hmm. What's this one?
So Julia Levy, she's now a Baltimore-based artist. She grew up in Philadelphia and then moved to Baltimore to attend graduate school at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's landed herself there. She's always been interested in how we choose to decorate our homes and that relationship between interior design and fine art. Additionally, she has this fondness for working with textiles, and so she creates these abstract, she calls them paintings, but they're made from multimedia materials, including fabrics, and they reference some sort of home furnishing that you might find, but they've been simplified and installed in an installation-based way. So she will take over our Hennessy Project space, which is made for that purpose. It's made, the program is identifying artists who want to come in and take over the entire gallery from floor to ceiling in whatever way they want to communicate what they're looking at. So when you walk into her space, it will be like walking into a redesigned home through these abstract forms.
Oh, wow.
It's very interesting. Yeah, it's a nice show. I read a little bit of work and talked to her. She grew up with a father who collected antiques. and antiquities, things that you couldn't touch. And so her relationship to objects is buried, is very real. And so she brings this really nice balance to the program.
Thanks to the Delaware Contemporary's Executive Director, Leslie Schaefer, and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on Arts Playlist. To learn more about objectifying the object and everything else happening at the Delaware Contemporary, log on to decontemporary.org. And we finish up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where this week we highlight work from student journalists at the University of Delaware. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Occasionally, The Green takes time to highlight work created by student journalists, including those at the University of Delaware. And despite the challenges created by the COVID-19 pandemic, these students continue to do their work telling stories about issues and topics they find interesting and important. In this week's Enlighten Me, we highlight pieces produced by UD Communications students for a class taught by Nancy Karabjanian, longtime first aid journalist, director of UD's Center for Political Communication, and one of the founders of Delaware Public Media. We start with senior communications major Callie Westerland, who notes it's been nearly a year since the pandemic forced UD to close its doors. And she catches up with seniors who were devastated to have their final semester cut short.
Being a senior in college the March of 2020 was pretty much a plot out of a teen sci-fi movie. Their worlds were turned upside down by a virus no one could cure. You can ask any Blue Hen where they were when UD shut down. For graduated senior Pat Teague, it was his 22nd birthday.
It was like, what do you mean we're going to be shutting down?
Just like that, the class of 2020 had to cut ties with Newark for good. No more late nights cramming at the library. No more regrettable Saturdays at Grottos. No more college. Everyone was headed home. Even professors like Juliette D were at a loss for words.
It really hit me on Thursday, March 12th, that I had been so lucky to be teaching in person.
Professor D planned to give an exam to 520 students that day. Instead, she couldn't get Joni Mitchell's song, Big Yellow Taxi, out of her head.
But that refrain from that Joni Mitchell sang, that kept going through my mind for the rest of the spring.
It was true. No one knew what they had until it was gone. For many seniors, reality kicked in when they found themselves finishing their degree from their childhood bedrooms and searching for jobs that just didn't seem promising.
I have a folder on my desktop of every cover letter I ever wrote, and there's 106 of them.
In between cover letters, Pat started a podcast called Fun Employment, a word he made up to describe the condition of being employed or unemployed and having fun doing it, something many people needed to hear.
And so it was all the while like a creative outlet and at the same time a way for me to like make myself more valuable to employers by having this like audio resume, so to speak.
For other graduates, this time of isolation forced them to learn more about themselves. Carrie Steve believes quarantine better prepared her for her graduate program at Thomas Jefferson University.
I think it gave me opportunity to learn a lot more about myself, and it allowed me to realize that I was a lot stronger than I thought I was.
Although UD shutting down its campus doesn't even compare to the tragedies that have come with COVID-19, it taught the class of 2020 that sometimes life doesn't go as planned. Living in these uncertain times, all you can do is take time to appreciate what makes you happy. Be present, be positive, be proud to be a Blue Hen. For UD News, I'm Callie Westerland.
Thanks to senior communications major Callie Westerland for her reporting. Next up, we hear from another senior communications major, Quinn Kirkpatrick, who reports that during the pandemic, local businesses faced some nearly insurmountable obstacles to keep serving customers, leading them to reinvent their marketing and service plans.
Beginning Tuesday at 8 a.m., all non-essential businesses are closed.
Governor Carney's stay-at-home order was announced on March 22, 2020, and went into effect 2 days later. For small local businesses, this was a terrifying and confusing ordeal.
There was really no guidance for businesses, especially a business like mine, on how to handle this. So we were actually considered an essential business, but we chose to close for 6 weeks just because we didn't know what the hell was going on.
That was Olivia Brinton, one of the owners of Little Goat Coffee Roasting in Newark, Delaware. Despite being considered an essential business, her shop could no longer operate as a cozy hangout for college students to enjoy a cup of coffee with their friends while squashed together on an old, swampy green and pink floral couch. But she and her team weren't the only ones confused. Kyle Hinkle, a local Delawarean, felt the same.
I don't think local businesses or people in general were prepared for the full scale of the shutdown and certainly the length.
With no way of knowing exactly how long the pandemic would last, many businesses did what they could to stay afloat. This meant adapting to the current environment they lived in.
So we ended up using social media, especially Instagram and Facebook, as just ways to get information out to our customers.
Social media is a tool that many businesses have taken advantage of, especially over the course of the last few months. While some establishments already had an online presence, others had to quickly adapt.
Just so many places did not have online commerce or ways to order ahead online, things like that. Some didn't even have carryaway. And now almost every business has an online presence, a carryaway option.
Many of the most popular social media sites don't cost money to use, offering a unique opportunity for businesses to snag some free advertising.
Instagram is pretty much all of our advertising. It's how I get the word out about anything that's going on here.
But social media isn't a one-way street. The very nature of the digital tools to allow communication between parties, and customers seem to really enjoy that aspect of it. Being able to hear directly from their favorite local businesses about what was going on during the shutdown allowed for customers to take action in different ways.
The biggest thing I saw was just like a pretty much ubiquitous outpouring of support for local businesses.
Not wanting their favorite places to close, many Delawareans use social media to tell their friends and followers to do what they could to help local businesses.
We've had nothing but like overwhelming kind of like rallying around Little Goat because we're very transparent about who we are and what we stand for, and people love to grab onto that.
While the effects of the pandemic are still very present in Delaware, there's much to be said about the versatility of local businesses and the loyalty of their customers, all of which can be observed on social media. With the University of Delaware News, I'm Quinn Kirkpatrick.
Thanks to UD's Senior Communications Major Quinn Kirkpatrick and her classmate, Senior Callie Westerland, for enlightening us this week with their features reporting on the pandemic from a student perspective. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, UD Communications majors Quinn Kirkpatrick and Callie Westerland, as well as Delaware Public Media Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.